Welcome to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today we present a special interview commemorating the life and career of Michael Ringo, one of the good guys in comic books, and people who knew him better can tell you about that. My own feelings about Mike stem from the fact that he was the first creator to approach me about Word Balloon, rather me going after them, because Jeff Parker was one of my first interviews, among the first four shows that I posted at Word Balloon. And Mike emailed me because he was having trouble downloading the show, which afforded me the opportunity to book him and have him on for this great conversation and subsequent email conversations that we had. And I always enjoyed hearing from him, and just a really good guy. Like I said, I didn't know the man well. I'll let the people who did know him well tell better stories and tell you more about the man. But I wanted to share this conversation that we had with him. So without further ado, Mike Ringo from 2005 on Word Balloon. The conversation starts off with Mike talking about his beginnings in the comic book field.
I started in earnest on The Flash right around the middle, maybe, of 93. And I guess the boom has been going for a couple of years, and it was like a big of almost overripe fruit. You know, everybody had tons of money, high expectations of it continuing, and just as I was getting in, the reality started setting in of you know, the fans and speculators who had thought they were going to be making sending their kids to college with the comic books they were buying, with all the gold foil covers and the lenticular covers and the acetate covers, started to realize they were basically worthless, and then started throwing them away and stopped buying comics.
What's your take on that, Mike? Because and you know, don't get me wrong, because I know you just take the assignments as you're given them. But for example, the current project of the other that you're working on Spider-Man,
right,
you're one of these multi-cover guys yourself. They're fun.
That's right.
And they're great. They really do look great. What's your take on all that?
Although, you know, I've done it on personal projects, like with issue four of the creator-owned book I did with Todd DeZego, Tell Us, we had four different covers.
Okay.
I was a little hesitant to do it then, but then we were kind of working with Nick Barucci at Dynamic Forces, and he was kind of giving us some advice along the way, and he was adamant that doing four variants on the fourth issue would help drive sales and keep them up really high, and it didn't really work out that way. But so I'm not a huge fan of variant covers and alternate covers, but I guess as long as people keep buying them, the company's going to keep doing them. I mean, the only way for people who don't want them to make their views known is to not buy them.
Well, the nice thing is, I guess, for the trade, you get a lot of, you know, neat little art, and that kind of helps beef up the trade.
Extras, yeah.
Actually, before we get into any of the current stuff, and I do want to talk about that, I'm digging what you're doing with Peter David. The books look great, and it's a multi-part story. But I want to go back first. Before The Flash, did you do Doc Savage?
Yep, I sure did. It was a two-issue Doc Savage miniseries published by a small company called Millennium Publications back in 92, I guess.
Okay. And was this pretty traditional? I've seen the covers. I haven't read the books. I'm a huge Doc Savage fan. So was it taking place in the 30s, or was it a modernization of Doc Savage?
From what I can remember, it took place in the 30s.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Terry Collins was the writer.
Okay.
And he was a huge Doc Savage fan, and I enjoy doing period stuff like that, so it was a lot of fun, but it certainly, being my first published work, was not pretty by any means. In fact, I took the first issue, the published issue, to San Diego when I was trying to get work with Marvel and DC, and every time I would pull it out, any editor I happened to be talking to would tell me to put it back away as quickly as possible because it wouldn't help my case.
Wow.
Like, they've seen it, but don't show it to me again. You know?
Let's never talk about it again.
Right.
So how did you hook up with Mark Waid then on The Flash?
I had been sending repeated submissions to the guys at the DC, and I had been going to San Diego for the big Comic-Con, I think, two or three years in a row. Like, nah, maybe it was 2 years ago. I went out there in 91 and 92, and probably 93, I guess. But so they were able to put a face with the constant submissions. I mean, I was always working on new samples and mailing them to the guys at DC. And there was a man at DC at the time. His name was Neil Posner, who was kind of in charge of finding new talent, and he liked what I was doing, and he saw some, I guess he saw some promise in my work, and he would actually give me personal phone calls, which I thought was really nice, and encourage me and tell me to keep working. And he was a real advocate for me, and he would pass my work around to all the editors whenever I would send in submissions, and you know, really press them to try to give me something, at least even a backup here or there, to do stuff, something at DC. Eventually, Brian Augustin and his assistant Ruben Diaz thought that I might be good to do a few short stories in a book they were doing called Justice League Quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the first one. And then they liked that, and I did the second one, and they liked that. And I was about halfway through the second one, and Brian Augustin called me and asked me if I'd be interested in working on The Flash full time. And I was there working in the grocery business at the time, and he knew that I was always there. I was working full time because every time he would call to talk about some of the pages, I'd be at work. And when he called to offer me The Flash, he put it in such a way as... like, if I offer you this book, would you be willing to quit your job at the grocery store? And you know, I said, sure, I think I could do that.
That's cool. What did, at the grocery store, was that like a union job and everything?
Yeah, no, this was a very, no, there's no unions, just a lot of hard work.
And, ouch.
Not a lot of pay.
Oh, man. Well, I understand.
Fortunately, I was still living with my parents, but...
If it's any consolation, when I was starting in radio, I was delivering pizzas for Domino's, and many times I would be on a sports talk show in my Domino's polyester talking about boxing and stuff like that. So believe me, I can relate.
Right.
All right, back to you. Let's talk about The Flash. You guys really had a great thing going. I mean, it was a great look for The Flash, and certainly Mark understood the character. Did you guys discuss the character a lot beyond, you know, just going over design and stuff?
No. Mark's always been the guy who's really had, his own... He's always known what he wants to do with the character, and, we spoke on the phone a lot, but mm-hmm. It was more about, I think, his encouraging me as far as my development. I remember when I was turning in pencils for the first issue, and I was on the phone with Brian, and Mark happened to be in the office, and he asked me if I wanted to speak to him, and I was, of course, more than happy to. I really wanted to actually meet him, and so we spoke on the phone, and he was a little bit, I don't know. That first issue I thought really turned out horribly.
Okay.
And he was very encouraging, but I could tell by the tone of his voice that he wasn't exactly, jumping up and down with enthusiasm over the work. So I remember when I finished, when I started working on the third issue and he started seeing pencils from that, he actually called me at my home and was just going on about how much I had improved and how excited he was and how just everything seemed to click. And I don't know, Mark's always been, a really wonderful guy to work with and somebody who's always, been... he's one of my biggest boosters. I just really think Mark's a great guy.
Do you feel like you stretched then when you were working with Mark and found yourself going into different directions?
Well, Mark's always made me draw things that I wasn't entirely comfortable drawing.
Okay.
Which would push me in directions that I never would if I were writing my own stories. I would definitely stay away from some of the stuff he's asked me to draw. But although it's been frustrating, it's also, I think, helped me learn and grow. But, like that third issue I was talking about,
mm-hmm.
I had to draw, it was in the first issue. I had to draw a baseball stadium.
Okay.
And, for somebody who had been doing his own samples for years and would only draw what he felt like drawing, that was really, really a shock to my system, being asked to draw all this different stuff that, I would never have written for myself.
Mm-hmm.
But the beauty of Mark's stories is the strength of the characterization. I remember, the first script I ever got from for Flash for that very first issue, and it's been like that ever since. Every issue that of anything I've ever drawn of Mark's, when I would read it, I would immediately get pulled into the story. It's something that doesn't really happen that often with other writers. But I would read his script, and immediately I would be like pulled right into the story. His scripts are just that strong.
Well, and your characterization really comes through as well. And I'd point to your guys' work on Fantastic Four, and specifically
one of my favorite moments, just looking at Franklin Richards when he finally just snaps, at, you know, when he's out with the thing and the Invisible Woman and really just kind of lashes out, and finally that weight of being in hell finally just comes through. And you really captured that moment.
Oh, well, thanks, man.
Yeah, you know, it was cool. It was, no, it really was. Because you really have a bright... Your art always looks very bright and has almost this positive kind of light around it, it almost seems. And the times that you've been asked to come up with, I think, heavy emotional scenes and stuff, the payoff is there.
Well, I can do emotions on faces, but I don't really do well with, I don't know what you would call it, lighting for the darker subject matter. I'm not comfortable with that kind of thing. And the weird thing is that lately everything I've been asked to draw, from, you know, a lot of the stuff in Fantastic Four to what's going on in Spider-Man now, has been so dark, it's just totally against my nature.
Do you,
I've always been a huge animation fan and a fan of sort of, I guess, I don't know, adolescent coming-of-age adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these kind of dark, super melodramatic, very violence-filled and angst-filled stories are just, I don't know, they just, sometimes I feel like they're pulling me down.
So the other has been kind of a challenge then, would you say? The Spider-Man story you've been working on?
It's been a huge challenge, yeah.
I'm wondering, too, about working with the three different writers, Reggie Hundlin, J. Michael Straczynski, and Peter David. From a script standpoint, let's throw Mark Waid in there, too. The two guys like Reggie and Joe Straczynski, coming from movies and TV, is it a much different script than what you would get from old comic book hands like Peter David and Mark Waid?
I think so. I think that, although the second issue written by Reginald Hudlin, I had a blast with, because it was written like an old-style Marvel comic. Spider-Man
okay.
went all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he teamed up with half the characters in the Marvel Universe, or at least passed by them in the hallway, and, you know, I got to draw so many different characters. It was a lot of fun. It really seemed to me like an old-school comic, but I think a lot of the stuff that some of these guys from TV and movies are writing when they come into comics, that 30-minute scene that takes place in one office, which would translate into, 10 pages, mm-hmm. Half of an issue in a comic book, it's easy enough to film and can be interesting to watch as far as the dialogue and the character interaction, but to have to draw it, it's excruciating.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of the fact that so many writers these days seem to be more enamored with writing intelligent dialogue, which is great. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to go back to the days of the 1960s where mm-hmm. it's all hokey and, you know, Stan Lee driven.
Sure.
But, you know, I would like to see some more interesting things happening while this dialogue is going on. That's the thing I like about Mark's work, is that he's able to keep the script moving and keep the characters moving, but at the same time, they're speaking as if, you know, as normal people would speak, and the dialogue is very strong. A lot of the stuff, you know, I don't read a whole lot of superhero comics anymore, because I'll pick up a comic book and it's just page after page after page of people standing around and talking, and I just put it back. You know, there's nothing interesting visually to hold my interest. I just, you know, there's no reason for me to take it out of the store with me.
Were you able to coax or suggest different scenes then to Hudlin and Straczynski in terms of what they were giving you? Or is this pretty much, hey, this is the assignment? I know you guys are on a tight deadline as well, obviously. I mean, it's...
Absolutely.
It, you know, this is... And yeah, I mean, just in general anyway, but also for this crossover. So was there wiggle room in this story, or as far as an artistic way?
Not really, no.
Okay.
I've just been drawing what I'm given.
Okay.
There's really not a whole lot of time to go back and tweak things or to make any kind of requests as far as having stories rewritten, and I'm not sure I would be in a position to ask for that anyway.
Okay. No, I understand.
But especially on this crossover event, things are really to the bone as far as scheduling goes.
You and Peter have started Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man. It did start with this story. You guys eventually will be able to go off and do your own thing. Have you had discussions? I mean, do you know that direction? And is that going to be, everyone assumed, I think, with you as the artist and Peter David as the writer, that this would be the lighthearted Spider-Man book, and that this would be kind of the bouncy fun book and the wisecracking book.
I think that's what Peter has in mind. Yeah, more of a traditional
yeah.
Spider-Man book.
Yeah.
That's about all I've you know, we've had one phone conversation and maybe a couple of emails back and forth very briefly, but you know, Peter's always on the go. If you ever read his blog, he goes to, I think, almost every every comic book, science fiction, and fantasy show in the United States, it seems. And so between going to all the shows and writing novels and, you know, writing screenplays and everything else that he does, it doesn't leave a lot of time for communication. But the comics these days are so writer-driven now anyway. I don't know about other artists, but it's been my experience since getting back into working freelance after finishing up the Tello stuff that, mm-hmm. you know, it's just draw what you're given, and if you can improve the story by adding a beat here or there, like there were a couple of pages in the second issue that some of the storytelling seemed a little bit jumpy, so okay. I would add a panel here or there just to make it seem a little bit smoother and transition a little bit easier, but beyond that, there's not a whole lot of input allowed.
Well, and it is. I think you're right. I think it has become kind of the writer's world right now, and that's the era we're in. And it, I guess, coming after the Image era, where it was the artist first, maybe, and the writer was secondary.
Yeah.
So, have you gotten any indication of future arcs in Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man?
I have a peek at what's coming up in a couple, you know, in the next couple of issues,
mm-hmm.
and it's fun stuff. It's definitely not. It's definitely moving away from the dark stuff that's been going on in the other. But I don't really have any idea what's coming up as far as arcs go. But you know, I remember I didn't read the book religiously, but I remember Peter when he was writing Supergirl or Young Justice at DC. He always threw in between, I guess, multi-issue story arcs, he would throw in a liberal smattering of, you know, single-issue stories.
Yep.
And I think he's going to do that probably for at least a few issues after, you know, starting with issue 5, just to sort of cleanse the palate and to try to help reset the tone for the
sure.
book, because, you know, I personally would have rather Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man be able to set the tone for itself and come out of the gate as an independent title rather than being tied into the other two. But I also cannot argue with the success that they've had with their sales. I mean, the fact that they're actually going into second printings of almost every Spider-Man book that's coming out tells me that people were looking for something like this. So, you know, I don't know if the sales on the first issue would have been as strong as they were if it hadn't been tied in with the other two books as part of a multi-story crossover.
I understand, but for one fan's opinion, I think it would have been. I think Peter's name associated with Spider-Man, you know, that goes without saying. I think people were very excited about Peter getting on the book. You have, you know, thrilled and delighted people with your runs on Fantastic Four and The Flash. And obviously that Fantastic Four run was a huge, despite, you know, the weirdness of the, you know, the interruption that you guys had
right.
in the middle of when you guys are doing things. Clearly the fans responded to what you were doing. I think they were excited about the team of you and David on Spider-Man. I think it would have happened regardless, and I agree with you. I wish it would have started on its own. But, you know, whatever. It's it is what it is. And you guys, you know, I'm glad to hear that you guys will be doing some single issues to, like you say, cleanse the palate. I think that's great.
Yeah.
Let's one other dark moment, if we can go back to your DC years. You had an inadvertent moment where in Adventures of Superman, and I'm sure you know where I'm going. I talked to Colleen Doran about this a few months ago when she did Orbiter, and it had the unfortunate timing of almost coming out at the time of the shuttle explosion.
Right.
And you had on Adventures of Superman 596 the inadvertent tie into 9/11 coming off of our Worlds at War. And
exactly.
Yeah, you know, can you go into that for people who aren't aware of what we're talking about?
As part of the Our Worlds at War crossover, there was, I don't know if they're still using it in the present Superman continuity now, but there was Lex Luthor had his own high-rise building in Metropolis that at the top of the building branched off into two or turned into two large towers,
mm-hmm.
or almost like a tuning fork. And the tops of those towers were completely blown away during the course of one of the, the battles with the invading aliens that they had. And it sparked a lot of... That was like the first time I had really become aware, I guess, of the strong internet presence.
Okay.
You know, the sort of debates that would go on in message boards and the kind of thing, the way things would spread like wildfire online.
Sure.
And it really did. The fact that it sort of mirrored events from September 11th, 2001 was, I guess, a little eerie in a lot of people's minds. You know, when I was drawing it, I don't recall even giving it much thought.
Sure.
But when it came out, it really, you know, I could see where people were coming from. But at that point, everything was very, very sensitive. I remember as part of that, I think it was an issue 500, there were a few scenes where the president or the vice president had a this massive flying ship that had the presidential seal on it. And they wanted to have that attacked by Lex Luthor when he was, I'm having a hard time recalling the story, but somehow he had a chip implanted in the back of his skull that sort of turned him from being the president of the United States into a more wacky sort of a supervillain character.
Okay.
And he started referring to himself as Alex Luthor. And he wore a wig, and it was always skewed to one side. And it was kind of a silly story. But as part of that, he was going to attack the vice president's flying ship. And I had to redraw all those scenes because it was so close to, you know, the plane attack.
Right.
So DC was being very, very careful during that time about anything they did that could be seen as being rather sensitive in the wake of what happened on 9/11.
Well, and obviously, no one thought that something like that could really happen. And you look at the history of comic books, buildings are blown up all the time,
yeah.
Massive alien invasions and trashing the skyline of a big city happens all the time.
Right.
And yeah, in this post 9/11 world now, I obviously that is a consideration and a concern. Each year that it passes, maybe it's less of a concern, but you know, the thought is still there. So no, people have to be sensitive to it. And you know, it's weird. I mean, you had this inadvertent kind of collectible point of discussion, but also a very sought out issue of a Superman comic book, and it, you know, maybe wouldn't have been maybe if it hadn't been for September 11th.
Absolutely, that was another thing that kind of shocked me was seeing how people tried to profiteer off of that immediately afterwards. All the eBay auctions.
Yep.
Where people were pointing out the similarities between what happened in that issue and 9/11, and you know, the books going up in price and people trying to bid on them. People that might not have even read Adventures of Superman, and you know, they were going for $10-$15 a pop, and that was really strange. It was a very strange time.
But then
you wonder if a movie like Independence Day, if it were supposed to have been released, say Christmas of 2001 or you know after the New Year 2002. If that wouldn't have been put off because of what happened in that movie.
Sure, look at the films that were shelved. I mean, I know Schwarzenegger had that Fireman movie, that Collateral Damage.
Collateral Damage, right.
And remember in the Spider-Man tease for the Spider-Man movie, you had the big web between the Twin Towers.
Exactly.
Gone. Yeah, it's, you know, I almost half the time I watch a Barney Miller episode, I'm expecting to see them, like, erase out the towers. To be honest, I think it went a little overboard after a while as well.
It really did.
But at the sensitivities, I guess. Let's talk about the Fantastic Four. Talk about the bizarreness of how first of all, you came in with that 9-cent issue. It set the tone of the lighthearted fun that you guys had on the book. And halfway through it, all of a sudden, you know, the announcement comes that, no, there's going to be this creative change. And nobody got it. None of the fans got it. And as you say, the eruption in the internet over the Superman issue, even more so, I think, at the outrage of taking you guys off of Fantastic Four at a time where everyone felt you guys nailed these characters.
Yeah, that was, you know, that was totally stunning. That was, to be honest, the sales on the book didn't really translate into the amount of outrage that I saw on on the internet. It was amazing to me that almost every comic book message board that I would go to, people would be talking about that. I could only assume that, as opposed to a lot of other comics, everybody that bought Fantastic Four was somebody who spent a lot of time on message boards, because they seemed to be everywhere, and everyone was almost 100% unanimous in their outrage over Mark being removed from the book. But it was a really strange time, and I've been at Marvel at different points when there have been other strange times. You know, I was working at Marvel on another Spider-Man book.
Yes.
During the beginning of their bankruptcy.
Yeah, and you were on the Ben Reilly book, right?
Yes. And I remember going to the last Chicago Comic-Con right before Wizard bought it, and you know, Marvel's bankruptcy had just begun, and their setup was, pitiful to say the least.
Wow.
I mean, it was, as what I was used to seeing at the big shows, it was scary to see a gigantic company like Marvel have two tables with a handmade construction paper and painted cardboard backdrop that was supposed to look like a tech-covered door. It was really scary.
Wow.
But the Fantastic Four thing was really, really wild, but it was a period of time when, you know, Bill Gemmis was making a real splash for whatever, you know, however you were looking at it, positively or negatively, with a lot of the things he was doing at Marvel, some of the chances he was taking, and some of them were really successful and others of them weren't, but he decided that he wanted the Fantastic Four to go in a direction that Mark wasn't interested in, and when Mark told him he wasn't interested, he kind of thought that was going to be the end of it. You know, like, I'm writing this book, and I have my own ideas, and I appreciate your input, but that's not something I'm comfortable with doing. And he was as shocked as anyone when he got the call saying that they were going to bring in another writer. And that ended up being the Marvel Knights Fantastic Four book,
mm-hmm.
which has, you know, got its own following now. But I read the first issue of the script, and although I know the guy came from writing plays, and he knows how, I guess, you know, when you've got a stage as opposed to something on film, characters have to speak in a certain order as they're standing on stage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And his script made perfect sense to me. It was like he knew exactly how to write a comic book script and how the page needed to flow, and it was, I thought, from an artistic standpoint, it was great. I mean, he knew exactly what an artist would need to make everything make sense.
Okay.
But I wasn't that interested in the story. To me, it didn't ring true. I didn't think that the Fantastic Four could become bankrupt. I didn't think the Fantastic Four could lose all their money by having it embezzled by their
business manager,
by their accountant.
Yeah.
Because all Reed Richards would have to do is to just go, oh, well, I've got 3 million. Experiments that I've, you know, they've been sitting in a room over here. I can just haul one of them out and sell it to a corporation and make, $100 million.
No, you know something? It's funny. We all get sucked into the soap opera aspect of the comic book stories, and I completely agree with you, Mike. I've heard that Four is a good book. I haven't read it, and one of the reasons why was, yeah, that first arc made absolutely no sense. It really did. It just, you're right. I mean, the guy's a genius. So geniuses usually don't have and was an inventor of so many machines that, yeah.
Yeah.
It just didn't make sense. So.
And I think Mark actually, I don't think this was an intentional dig. I just think it was his way of saying this is, of stating what I just went through, a long time saying. Taking too many words to say, but there was a scene in an issue of Fantastic Four that we did where Johnny, after he's been made the financial guy at the Fantastic Four Inc., comes up to Reed and says, hey, our coffers are a little bit low, and is there anything you can do to help? And Reed says, yeah, I've got something that you can sell to Revlon or whatever, and that'll, just an offhanded remark.
Yep.
That just kind of undid all that would have been done in that first issue of what ended up being Marvel Knights 4. I just thought it was a very strange period. But for me, I ended up starting back on the book at the exact same point that I would have had I not left in protest to support Mark anyway.
Right, because Howard Porter came in,
yeah.
I think, in between?
Yeah.
Okay.
The only difference was that those issues that Howard did were originally intended to come out biweekly.
Okay.
And instead of having an 8-month unpaid vacation, as I did, it was supposed to only be 4 months of that storyline, and then I was going to come right back. So as things dragged out, and I was talking to the guys at DC about doing something over there, and then, you know, Marvel would get back to me, and there was just a big back and forth between both companies, and that sort of dragged things out. And then eventually, like I said, I ended up being right back where I was going to be in the first place.
That's cool.
It took a little bit longer.
The other great story that you guys did on the Fantastic Four was the Heaven arc as well. And what a great idea, and good looking Kirby, man. You did a good job. It was really great. It was, again, fun, and another heavy moment in that story, the story before it, obviously, with the thing seemingly dying.
Right.
And yeah, coming up with the Heaven story afterwards. No, it was really great, man.
I really loved that story. I thought it was Mark's idea to have them go meet the creator and it be Kirby. I just thought it was amazing. And it was really wonderful to be able to draw that story and to be able to draw Jack Kirby. And fortunately, I had an old it was a book that Kevin Eastman published years ago. It was a Jack Kirby collection type of thing. It was called The Art of Jack Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a section in the back that had a whole lot of pictures of various people visiting Jack in his what ended up being his last studio in California.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a lot of reference for what his studio looked like, and it was it helped a lot with that.
Did you ever have a
chance? A lot of that furniture and a lot of that, the way things were set up in their room, is actually the way, at least from the angle when they first come in, is what Kirby's studio actually looked like.
Did you have a chance? I know you came in pretty close to the time where Jack passed away, but
yeah.
Did you have a chance to see him at any of the cons or anything before he passed?
No, unfortunately, I never once even laid eyes on Jack Kirby.
No.
And that's the sad thing about that. I never once got to meet him, and only once saw Will Eisner in passing as he walked past me out at the San Diego Con one year, and that was it.
That's too bad.
Two amazing talents, two giants gone, and I never, you know, once got the chance to even tell them how much I appreciate their work.
Who of those, you know, the elite, would you say influenced your work?
How far back you?
Go as far back as you want, man.
Well, you know, I started buying comics on my own in the mid '70s.
Okay.
When we got back from my dad was in the army, and we were stationed in Germany, and we got back in late 1974.
Okay. So you were about the same age. Okay.
So I started buying my own books off the, you know, from the newsstand, and of course I immediately gravitated toward the Marvel comics, and you know, I was a big fan of guys like Jim Starlin.
Mm-hmm.
That cosmic stuff that he was doing then was just really blowing my mind.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it was really awesome. The Captain Marvel work, and then later the Warlock stuff, and I just really loved it, and I was a huge John Byrne fan and a big Dave Cockrum fan. I loved
sure.
the stuff he did on Legion of Superheroes, and then later Uncanny X-Men, and his sense of design and just the way he drew were just you know, all really big influences on me. And but even like, you know, I loved my father was a huge DC fan, so he bought a lot of DC comics, and
okay.
I loved Jim Aparo's work when he was doing Brave and Bold.
Absolutely,
those, you know, I couldn't wait until the next team up, see who Batman was going to be teaming up with next.
Yep, and at that definitive kind of Batman look of the early
'70s,
him,
yeah.
Irv Novak, Neil Adams.
Absolutely, and you know, these are all guys whose stuff when I was young, when I was 12 years old, I would sit down and try to copy their work. You know, none of that shows in anything that I do anymore, but they were, you know, huge and instrumental in my love of comics. But, you know, I was the kind of person who never really got Kirby until I got to be a little bit older.
Okay. It
wasn't until I was almost out of high school that I really started going back and appreciating how amazing Jack Kirby's imagination and his talent and realizing just how much work he had done and how much he was responsible for over the years, and how if it weren't for a guy like Jack Kirby, there probably wouldn't be a Marvel comic.
Oh, definitely.
So, I mean, you know, fortunately, a lot of that stuff was being reprinted at the time, and Kirby himself in the mid to late 70s was back at, you know, finishing up his stuff at DC and going back to Marvel, and he had those, you know, really fun runs on Black Panther and creating Devil Dinosaur and doing the 2001 Space Odyssey stuff and the Eternals. I love the Eternals.
Oh, yeah.
That was just, to me, that was just totally amazing. I couldn't get enough of the Eternals.
Did you remember getting that Captain America he did to coincide with the Bicentennial, too?
No, I found that much, much, much later.
Because that really blew my mind, even as a kid and everything. And I think that was like the first Kirby where I was like, wow. I mean, because the scope of it, too, just going through the years, really, it played to his strengths as well, just giving you all these different visuals and stuff as Cap was going through time.
And the fact that it was a Treasury edition.
Absolutely. You know, to be honest,
Kirby two up, it was amazing. You know?
Yeah, and you know, that was really my introduction to Marvel. I grew up as a DC kid, and it was those Treasury edition, Fantastic Four, Doctor Strange, all that stuff, Spider-Man. You know, I always knew Spider-Man from the cartoons and stuff, and all those Marvel superheroes from the cartoons.
Right.
But yeah, I think it was those Treasury editions that really made me appreciate what Marvel was doing.
Well, you know, I guess early on, maybe before I was that heavy into comics, I think it was perceived that the DC comics were better drawn and Marvel comics seemed to be a little bit more on the amateurish side.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was a lot of the guys that were working at DC were illustrators that were having a hard time finding work in illustration.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had these classic influences and classic learning and education. And the guys at Marvel were just kind of flying by the seat of their pants, loved comics, and you know, were bringing in different types of influences and more pop culture influences. But I think that was an energy and a youthful appeal that really, you know, grabbed a lot of kids.
Oh, absolutely. And there was that, DC had that kind of clean house style. I mean, everything was really clean. And yeah, you're right, Marvel, it's like jazz compared to, you know, maybe a piece of classical music.
Right.
Where, you know, yeah, it really is the improvisation of the art that kind of, you know, gives it its energy and everything.
But both companies during those mid-70s period, that mid-70s period, I have really fond memories of that because, you know, both Marvel and DC were throwing everything they could up against the wall to see what would stick.
You bet. You know? A lot of different genres. You're absolutely right.
That's where Firestorm came from. That's where Ragman came from. That's where Steve Ditko ended up, you know, right before he kind of faded away from the big two. And he did, what was that book?
Shade? Shade the Changing
Man? Well, he did Shade, but there was also...
Oh, The Creeper and Hawk and Dove and...
Yes, Sword and Sorcery comic also that he did that only had like three or four issues and that got canceled. And for some reason, Slayer, that was what it was called.
Oh, okay. And was that part of the DC?
Yeah.
Okay, because, yeah, you're right, man, DC, well, that and all the horror stuff and all the weird mystery, or Mike Grell doing Warlord and stuff like that.
Yes, that's where all, you know, both companies, I guess, you know, the comic book industry was in kind of dire space just as it was not that long ago, and they were just trying to do anything they could to attract attention. I know a lot of really fun stuff came out of that.
Now, you're a fantasy fan, and I know you created Telos. Would you ever want to do like a Conan or a Sword and Sandal kind of fantasy book?
Yeah, I think I'd love to.
Okay.
I would love to. You know, I don't know if I would. I don't know if I'd want to do Conan, if only because I know that Conan fans would probably not dig it that much. You know, I just think that they'd be like, is this the Conan Adventures book? Is this Disney Conan? I know they're used to a certain level of, I think the stuff that Cary Nord and Dave Stewart are doing on that book, it looks almost like painted Frazetta stuff. It's just phenomenal. And I don't think they'd settle for anything less than that. But I would... you know, when I heard that the DC was going to be doing this Claw Witchblade crossover,
yes.
Claw was another one of those books that came out in the mid-70s. And I remember those early first few issues, first like five or six issues done by Ernie Chan. And then Keith Giffen came in and finished it out, and he just took Claw from being sort of a Conan with a demon hand and sent him off into space to other worlds.
Mm-hmm.
It blew my mind. And Claw's always been a character that I really love, and I always had in the back of my mind that, you know, I'd love to go back to DC one day and do a Claw comic, but now they're using them already.
Well, maybe Warlord. I know Warlord's coming back too. And
yep. Although is doing that as well.
Kind of pissed that they're not letting Grell do it. I got to be honest. You know, I'm a big Mike Grell fan, and that's his baby and everything. And it just kind of bumps me up.
That is a fear that I live with constantly, of ending up being one of these guys who ends up like a, you know, any number of these guys. Mike Grell, Dave Cockrum. I don't know what Mike Zeck's situation is. I don't know if he doesn't want to do work for Marvel or DC, but or if he does and can't, you know, that can't get anyone to answer his phone calls or what. But you know, that's the fear of the freelancer, and I think about that almost every day. It's like, wow, I really love the ride I'm on right now, but when does the conductor stop the car and say, okay, it's time for you to get off?
Are there more?
Thanks for all your help.
Well, are there more creator-owned projects that you'd like to tackle?
Oh, yeah, I've got a lot of ideas for stuff that I'd like to do.
It seems like it going to your website. I mean, your blog always has neat little images, and, you know, you throw up some images of characters that you came. I went up there today in preparation and noticed that you had ideas from your childhood that you said, little Swamp Thing-influenced ideas. And...
yeah. Yeah, but everything I did from my childhood, it was based on something that already existed. You know, I don't have anything that's why I'm so impressed and envious of somebody like Eric Larson, who had all these crazy characters in his head. The Savage Dragon stuff and all, you know, all these characters that he's introduced in Savage Dragon all came from his childhood. It's like, what an imagination he had. My characters were always, this is my version of Batman, and this is my version of Superman, this is my version of Man-Thing. And but, you know, I have some other stuff that I'd like to do, some stuff that's really not my version of some other characters.
Okay.
As I've gotten older and you know, grown my own imagination, but I guess the stuff that I want to do, again, it, mostly it's fantasy based, but it's also so lighthearted that I'm afraid that it might not click in the present marketplace.
Okay.
And creator-owned books in today's marketplace have a hard enough time as it is getting a foothold and becoming successful. So it kind of keeps me from pursuing it, just for fear of falling flat on my face.
Okay.
But I guess if nothing ventured, nothing gained. So if eventually I'm going to go for it anyway. But right now I'm still on I just signed a 3-year extension on my exclusive contract with Marvel. So
congratulations.
I'm kind of in with Marvel until 2008.
No, that's good, man. I really looking forward to more of the stuff on Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man once you and Peter are allowed to do your own thing and get out of the story. And I'm enjoying the other. I don't want to. I like the story. I don't mind that it's a dark story. And but yeah, I think people were looking for light stuff from you guys, and glad to see that it's coming up on the horizon. What about the Narnia film that's coming up? You're a fantasy fan. What do you think of that?
I'm excited. I'm glad the technology has caught up with the imagination of the original authors of all this material. I mean, the Lord of the Rings movies were just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to King Kong.
Me too.
You know, Peter Jackson has an amazing way of combining computer technology with live action, where it doesn't look fake to me.
Yep.
I was never a gigantic Star Wars fan, but I was still excited about the new Star Wars movies because I went to see the original Star Wars films when I was a kid.
Sure.
When that first prequel came out, I guess, and the very first time Qui-Gon is standing there and talking to, what's the character everyone hated?
Jar Jar Binks.
Jar Jar Binks. and he wasn't looking at him. Because they got, you know, maybe the green stick, the stick with the green ball that he was supposed to be speaking to, they were holding in the wrong place or whatever. And I just thought, I'd rather see the puppets come back than this. This is really terrible. But it seems to me like the computer technology is really caught up with the imaginations of the original authors of the material as well as the directors. And I just think it's a great time for, you know, these gigantic, big-budget fantasy epics. I think it's terrific.
I hope that Princess of Mars still happens, too.
Yes, that would be very nice.
Because you know, it seemed like Rodriguez was going to do it, and then something happened, and he pulled out of it. And
well, he was going to do Mad Men years ago too, but he keeps finding things that he gets sidetracked with. I'm sure Mike Allred is going, when am I next?
No kidding.
When does my movie get made?
Yeah, you made.
You were talking to me before you were talking to Frank Miller. What's going on?
I agree. No, you're right about that. You know, there's another interesting guy, Allred, too, that has kind of a fun cartoony style and stuff. You got to love him, man.
Absolutely.
Did you see that?
I'm a huge Mike Allred fan.
Dude, you left DC at the wrong time. You should have done a solo before you went back to Marvel exclusive. Man, those books, are fantastic. Those are really fantastic.
Yeah, I love them. The Jordy Bernay issue that came out not too long ago, that is just, I mean, I keep that out just to look at almost every day. His work is so fantastic. I just love it.
You know, I had never heard of him until reading about an ad for one of his art books that, you know, in one of the Tomorrow's magazines. That's where I first became aware of him.
Right,
and all these, man, the Europeans really need to penetrate the United States better. And their stuff needs to get better exposed, because I'm telling you, mainstream fans, you don't know what you're missing. You really don't. Some of these guys are incredible.
There's so much stuff being published in Europe that I think would blow the minds of the fans over here. One of the beautiful things of the internet is that I've started up a bunch of friendships with people over in France and Belgium, and for various reasons. And some of them are really generous, and Italy as well. And some of them are really generous about sending some European comics to me. And I've got a mini library full of all these French and Belgian and Italian albums, just, you know, with all this amazing artwork. I can't read any of them, but I can, because I don't speak Italian or French, but I can certainly sit there and you know, ogle the artwork and just be amazed. That's the wonderful thing about the European comic market, is that while superheroes are king here, everything goes over there. It's science fiction. Westerns are gigantic over there. They love Western comics.
Oh, I just got that Italian Tex comic book that Joe Kubert did the art for, and it was fantastic. And granted, it's Joe Kubert,
right?
But it was so neat to see this nice long, you know, Western being done by an American artist and stuff. But with that Italian sensibility, it's pretty evident even in the translation. You're right. Now I'm wondering too. Has your style made it over the other side of the globe? I mean, is there a possibility that where the genres here or may not be popular here, but might be popular on the other side of the world?
I've given that a lot of thought and spoken with a lot of these guys that I mentioned that I've met via the internet about that. And I just did an interview with I hate to call it the French equivalent of Wizard magazine, because I like the French equivalent better.
Okay.
But it's called Comic Box. And occasionally, the guy that interviewed me for the magazine was asking me if I was ever planning on doing any more Telus work, because, as he put it, he said, do you have any idea how popular that comic is over here? And I said, well, I don't know. Maybe now that you're saying it, maybe I do. But I remember when they were publishing the Telus book that we were doing at There was a company called Samik.
Okay.
And they sold really well. They even got a 5-page short story that we did into the French TV Guide.
Wow.
So it's very popular over there, and I still get emails from French fans through my website that are asking me if we're ever going to do any more Telus material. So that leads me to believe that, you know, it might be a good idea to do some more Telus material.
Absolutely.
So that's always a possibility. But barring that, I would still love to. My contact or my editor, who was in charge of the Telus reprints at Samik, has since moved to Delcor.
Okay.
Which is another large French publisher, and they only publish original material. And you know, I've talked with him about doing stuff there, and these other people that I talk to on the internet say they can give me contacts with some of the other publishers. And you know, I don't know if you noticed this, but there was a really big article on Newsarama probably about 6 months ago about the beginnings of this trend of American artists starting to do work for European publishers?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty evident.
Like Umberto Ramos and Scotty Young, and I know that Terry Dodson has been doing some stuff for Humanoids, and I think it's a really good idea to have as many outlets for your creativity and as possible.
No question. No, and I'm glad to see you're right, and they are. They're more receptive to the other genres as well, which gives you guys the opportunity to experiment in stories that you may not get an opportunity to do just working in the mainstream of American comics.
Yep, exactly. And they are very accepting of cartoony artwork married to serious subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain characters that I would never be able to touch over here, like the Punisher. Because it would just be laughed off the stand. You know, what is this? But if I were to do a book similar to The Punisher over in Europe, it didn't matter how cartoony my work was; it would be accepted.
Sure.
So it's very, you know, it's funny how cultures are so different.
Yeah.
We went over to Paris, and Todd DeZago and I were flown over to Paris in 2000 when our first French edition came out, and we were in Paris, and then later this big show in a small medieval town called Angoulême. They have a gigantic show there every year. And there were shops, not comic shops, but comic stores. Almost every corner had a window display selling albums. I mean, it didn't matter if it was a jewelry store. They had a section of albums for sale. It was amazing.
That's cool. No, you're right. I'm really glad to see it happening. And yeah, just like we get excited about seeing a guy like Jodorowsky.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think as excited as Americans are to see that stuff, or some Americans, certainly Europeans would be happy to see the influx of some of the great guys we have here. Bring our boys around the world. I'm all for it.
Exactly. But you know, as your original point of getting some of that European material published over here. I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
I wish I know that DC just tried it with the Humanoid stuff, and I guess it didn't work out to their satisfaction, so they ended the agreement.
I know. I bought almost every one of those things. I really did. I enjoyed them so much. They were so fresh, just interesting stories, great art, and something different. And I think after a while, everybody at a certain point as a fan wants something different. They either go to the black and white indies,
yep.
or they go to the European, or they go to manga and things like that. So. There's nothing wrong with that. Are there characters that you haven't tackled yet at DC and Marvel that you would like to? I know you're talking about the Punisher. Maybe you would like to do the Punisher for real.
No, actually, I really wouldn't like to do the Punisher. But on the one hand, I would say I've been very, very lucky and very fortunate that I've always been given assignments that were characters that were top-level characters. I mean, I've worked on Fantastic Four, and I've done Robin.
Yes.
That was tied up in the big Batman crossovers during that time.
Mm-hmm.
I've already done a run on a Spider-Man book, and now I'm on another Spider-Man book. And
Superman,
you know,
of course.
I've always been given really high-level assignments, and that's wonderful. But they tend to get caught up in these crossovers. So it would be fun to take a crack at a more mid-level character.
Yeah, anybody.
That wouldn't be
tied to
subject to one of these crossovers and the whims of one writer dictating what all the other writers are going to write. You know, something like along the lines of, I know that Marvel are doing books with all these characters, but it would be fun to play with a single female character. I'd love to do Spider-Woman or Ms. Marvel.
There you go.
I know Marvel's doing... like I said, books with both of those characters, but something along those lines.
That's cool.
Hellcat, you know, a Hellcat miniseries or whatever.
I'm up for that. There you go. So, yeah, mostly the women. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I've except for a Rogue miniseries I did for Marvel many years ago, I've never really had the opportunity to do a book that was just based on a female.
Well, hope you get your shot. That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, listen,
but there's a lot of stuff at DC that I'd love to do, too.
Like? Well, and I know you mentioned Claw. Yeah, give me some of those smaller-tiered characters that you'd be interested in over there.
I'd like to do Captain Marvel, Shazam.
Oh, yeah.
Although he's not a secondary character. I mean, he's like one of their big characters. But
yeah.
I think my work would fit with that character.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that Jeff Smith
absolutely.
Project.
And I've been buying the Judd Winnick, Josh Middleton miniseries that they've been doing.
Oh, that First Thunder?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a lot of fun.
That's cool.
Aquaman would be fun.
Sure.
DC has just such a gigantic library of characters. And the Metal Men would be a blast to do.
Yeah. That's cool.
I'd love for them to resurrect the Inferior Five, you know? Plastic Man. I know they just finished up with Kyle Baker's Plastic Man series, but
yes.
I would love to do Plastic Man.
That's, I could see that. I could definitely see that. That's fun.
Just something on the quirky side.
Sure.
Lighter tone.
Oh, that's cool. Fun with Binky.
Wasn't
it Binky?
On the Ape, you know, whatever.
Yes. Yeah, they brought that back a couple years ago, too.
Exactly. Yeah, with Philip Bond. I love Philip Bond stuff.
That was really cool. No, I agree.
Unfortunately, I haven't been like a lot of guys who have had such a varied career as far as, you know, jumping back and forth between creator-owned stuff to company-owned material. I've only done one side project in my whole career.
I hope you get the opportunity, like, you know, with maybe these European markets to kind of explore some of these other creator ideas.
Oh, I'll pursue it eventually.
Well, that's cool. And again, we'll be enjoying your work in Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man in the meantime. It's a great team-up of you and Peter David, and we're looking forward to a lot of fun on that.
Thanks, man. We'll do our best.
So from 2005, a nice conversation with Mike Rowingo. Rest in peace, Mike. Word Balloon will be back this week with our regular coverage. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007.